This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
To Richard and to George, my question is, do you know why you are here together, this show happened at the same time?
With all respect to George, one of the things that I think makes our work compatible or complementary has to do with something I've talked to Aaron about, which is the fact that I think it's art without art. And I'm not sure I know what that means for me, and I'd like to hear what you think about that. But I talk about this, actually, recently I mentioned it in a seminar, that sometimes the when an artwork is sort of burdened with its identity as art, it reduces the kinds of responses that it can elicit in a viewer. And one of the projects for this particular opportunity, or the goals, was to stick with what was here and not add anything, or to be conspicuous about adding anything, and that sort of working with the given, and in the process of discovering what that is, sort of, it's almost like all the stuff that's here is apparent. It's always available, but it needs to be transformed or squeezed out of the familiarity somehow. And I think that in a way, these sculptures of yours are also sort of releasing new ideas for properties or conditions for these stones that we would never understand or realize on our own. And somehow that process of discovering something that we never, even in our own familiarity with what we're doing, we're constantly being surprised, I think, by the sort of infinity of what's out there to be tapped, is maybe one way of talking about the similarity.
Well, all right, just taking that idea, I don't know how anybody knows what art is previous to its happening. That's my situation. So I'm not very personally preoccupied with the idea of being without art, because to me the question that comes from the other side, which is the same question, the same way of thinking about it really, is when is it art, and why? What's the advantage in calling it art? At what moment does it become an advantage to your activity to think of it as art? And I think that civilization has obviously, at least our civilization, not all civilizations, has canonized this act with a very particular charge, a very particular historical authority, so that it's come to the point where it's honorific. If I can call it art, it must be something important. And if it's not art, maybe it's not as important, something like that. At least that's how the mind tends to work about it. And I think of that whole state of mind as problematic. When you have the orientation that allows you to think honorifically about your own activity before it even happens, then, you know, that's a very peculiar situation to be in. I really wonder whether it optimizes our aliveness, our ability to be alive. I mean, I think that people are attracted to art because they think they're going to feel more alive, or they feel that they're going to be more intensely present, or they're going to know something they couldn't otherwise know, or they're going to be in a state they couldn't otherwise be in. That it's a charge; it has a power. But if that charge exists previous to the act, then it's a strange, to me, it's a curious reality. So for me, everything that I'm involved in arises because it arises in itself, you know, that not because I'm good at it. And I think that one of the problems about, one of the interests of stating something to be art without art is you're getting out from under, in my understanding, the burden of thinking you know what you're doing. It's a heavy burden. Because then you're competing with yourself. You're not only competing with everybody else, you're competing with yourself. You make something that really turns you on, you think is great, and you've accomplished something. And then you should do it again, right? I mean, if you did it and it's really good, why can't you do it again? Why can't you be as good as you are? So it's always comparative, and it's always in competition with something, as though we need that state of competition to drive us to our own nature, to our own whatever we are. You know, we don't even know that. But, you know, if assuming that we want to be what we are, then art should be somehow connected to that process of finding that out. And if you already know in advance what you are completely, well, then bomb the rest of the people who aren't like that. Because why aren't they like you? Okay. I'll try. Okay, these two objects on the stand there are natural objects. That is to say, I found them. I didn't do anything to them. I didn't change them. I got interested in them because of what they are. They're interesting to me just as they are. Did I know why? No. Do I know why now? No. What I found out, however, was that when they got near each other, something powerful happened, and they induced me to behave in a particular way that allowed them to do that. So it's a kind of a collaboration. It's a kind of, for me, it's rising to the occasion of what something is in itself. And they became something that I didn't see previously. That is, they became more than themselves, and so in some sense I was more than what I thought I was previous to that moment. So we got together like that. I'm having a little trouble getting all you're saying. I'm getting part of it, but I'm sorry.
I'm wondering if you're investigating something about yourself in this vertical axis that goes against the earth and into, you know, what is very sensitive.
Right.
State of balance.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, first of all, on a matter of principle, I think that our ability to discover what something is that we don't know previous to that moment happens out of a discovering something in common. I mean, either we speak a language, or we find a subject, or we find a state of something that allows us to interact meaningfully. And the axis is something that I take it that everything that's upright has something in common. They're all operating on an axis. They fall over otherwise. Now, stones don't behave like that on their own. So in a certain sense, I'm colonizing them. I'm attracting them to be upright like me. Now, but I'm trying to do it with their permission, because I don't bang them around, I don't change them, I don't force them to do it, and I don't tell them how it's supposed to look in advance. So that common assumption about an axis and the discovery of my own axis is actually an act of communication, not an act of personal investigation only. Am I addressing your question?
That point about gravity is something that I think also is operating in the projections, because both bodies of work, in a way, expose this thing we take for granted constantly, which is the sort of presence of gravitational energy.
Right.
And I mean, in a way, that there's so many subjects that emerge from both of our work, but the thing that I'm constantly reminded of is how that gravity becomes a subject of the projections, and at every scale.
Why? And when things are upside down?
Suddenly you notice how people walk, the way that the gravity's pull, and this sort of, as was just indicated, the sort of, in a way, it's all going towards the center of the, and there are it's just, gravity is such a form maker. We are constantly negotiating and resisting or dealing with gravity, and again we don't we would go insane if we had to think about that all the time. But
well, here's a possible connection. At the moment that you see something upside down, you're released from the ordinary sense of gravity. That is to say, you're studying, at least, the situation produced by gravity in a way that's not available ordinarily, right? So in that way, we have that in common because, for me, gravity is what we normally struggle against it. You try not to fall over, basically. And as you get a little older, you start to realize that that's an issue. And so the way in which you avoid falling over can either be by a willful act of holding yourself up, but you can do it with muscular tension, you can do it with canes, you can do it with pulleys, all kinds of ways you can keep yourself upright. But then there's a kind of way in which you stop struggling and you discover a state of release in that situation of gravity. And that's what interests me. I'm interested in whether you can find that moment where you are released from the struggle. Because if the struggle is not necessary, why are we doing it? And I think people are struggling kind of all the time. You know, one of the things you watch when you watch people walk like that, I don't know what you see, but what I see is I see people struggling. And they're struggling in very subtle ways. They're struggling in unconscious ways. They're It's amazing to me how many young people are struggling against their own bodies, which is a very sad situation in a funny way because they have these great bodies. They're you know, you don't have to do anything. You just have to walk out there and be great. That's because you are, and, you know, and yet they, you know, they're tense and they're like they're worried. And I remember, you know, being a teenager was one of the curses because you are constantly unsure of every move. You know, there's nothing there that's just right by itself for you. But you have this really fine instrument, you know, ready to do anything, but you won't let it. So strange. And yet, as you go along with that, you can discover through a practice of mind that's aware of what the possibility is. Just stop for a moment and see if you can stop struggling. What would happen? You know, you might faint.
Or you would stop being a child. Because I think you would stop being a child because childhood doesn't allow that kind of consciousness.
Well, I don't know. Very young children seem to not worry about it. They roll around and fall down, and they get up, and they do all these things. I think that tension is learned. Personally, I really feel that it's something that arises from social embarrassment of some kind. I really think society is a menace to health in that way. You know, it teaches kids to not trust themselves, to not trust what they are. And I think they get into bad habits pretty young, actually.
One question. There's something I think that's similar important in both these rooms, and you may or may not agree with this, but there's a malevolent or potential malevolent edge. I mean, these works in here are gravity dependent, but they're heavy, sharp, jagged objects that could fall at any moment. So this right. The other room, which is gravity resistance, the works of gravity resistance, it's still disturbing. Trees grow down or it blows up. You know, it's disturbing. Do either or both of you see or think of, the best word I keep coming up with is malevolence. Do you see that as part of that? Malevolence, danger, you know, there's this sort of dark edge. Well, in Richard's case, it has to be dark, but nonetheless, to either of these.
That's a new idea for me. I always go to some sort of innocent way of looking at the world that those images provoke, and that's what always this word I use with hesitation, which begins with W. And it's spelled W-O-N-D-E-R, but. it's something that it's a condition that I enjoy encountering, and I am careful to cultivate it or to cause it to happen, because I think part of its condition is this encounter. And to be trafficking in that, or to want to sort of instill that state in other people consciously, is something I feel a little strange about. I'm not sure that, so that in a way that...
I'm just curious if it's something that you consider.
Somebody once said that there's a hermeticism or a kind of, that the works provoke a need to sort of crash through because there's this feeling of distance that is suffocating. And I don't really sense that in the work because I'm so used to it, but I could see why people end up feeling, you know, snuffed by that, the sense of looking at something that they don't have access to or remove. Mm. But I think of it, in terms of your work, that these dead stones are very alive somehow, and so this feeling of even this liveness, this performance, this performative condition that not only is in a way suddenly everything outside is performing, and then there's this activity of looking at it also sort of is performing. Like I feel that it sort of frames this act of viewing, which is what I think your work also mm-hmm. does. There's this feeling of suddenly a kind of extra layer of awareness that comes through just encountering these, mm-hmm. you know, maybe both bodies of work. Because mm-hmm. there's this sense of, with yours, it's very static and though it's energized, but the feeling I always feeling that I'm missing something when I'm not near these things that mm-hmm. that I make, because mm-hmm. they're different all the time, mm-hmm. and I just even while I'm making them, all I want to do is look at them, mm-hmm. and that actually creates a problem because uh-huh. they don't get made or they don't get finished, and because uh-huh. I just want to right. I'm you know too seduced by that thing I'm talking about, but mm-hmm. I'll have to think about that.
Well, I mean, the situation of things being dangerous or being threatening in some way, I think that's a way of interpreting particular situations. He wouldn't let me put danger on a sign earlier.
That's true.
I was going to put danger, you know, falling yeah. rock zone or something like that. But he was right. That was a bad word. So I put a nicer word, caution, as his suggestion. But the thing is that's true. That pre-interprets a situation. You know, I really don't want people to get hurt, you know, bumping into the stones, and I don't want the stones to break. I'm very attached to them, you know, like them the way they are. But the situation in a more general sense of danger, of precariousness, of things that could be threatening is a mode of interpretation for the most part of how we see things. And for me, the art act is in part about making that not particularly one kind of interpretation, but where precariousness could be something very exciting. There are little statements on the wall in various places around here, and some of them are meant to suggest that's a state of possible excitement. In that, when you actually experience danger, I've watched people around the stones, for instance, who come in, they look at them, and they don't realize that they're actually balanced. And precarious. And they look at them and they say, oh, that's very beautiful, and oh, I like that very much, you know, and they'll go along. And then when they finally penetrates to them that they're balanced and that they might fall at any moment, the body kind of, first of all, tightens and gets a little, you know, and then they wake up a little bit more and they start to look around and they start to look at all the things they've looked at and wonder whether they're still beautiful or what they think about it now. And what I like about that is that the awareness of that state seems to remove our pattern of perception. And I think that's one of the things about getting out from under art is because art tends to, even though you'd think it would be the opposite, but actually it tends to reify our expectations about beauty or about meaning or about anything, whatever we're used to. And I think it's a very dangerous situation. I think consensus in art in general is very dangerous. I think consensus in life is a mixed blessing. It's hard to live without it, but let's not get too into it either, because it tends to take over. It really does. Comfort is a problem, I think. You know, it's not good for your posture. I'm not sure what it is good for. other than to sort of remove the outer layer of tension. It doesn't go very deep, but it tends to be, it's very seductive, comfort, you know. And our tendency to engage comfort is insidious. You know, you think you're really alive and you really got a great take on art and you're really smart, you got it figured out. But comfort seeps back in, you know, from underneath. And you start to look in these moments that are really groovy moments, you know, and you want to hang out there. I know what you mean about wanting to hang out in your art, but but your art is meant to sort of keep moving by itself. And so, therefore, what are you going to get attached to? You know, it's like everybody that goes by is interesting, you know, so you're going to get attached to them all. But, you know, for me, it's the fact that when I'm actually making the drawings, for instance, I make a lot of them, and I keep going. And I don't let myself look at them after I've just made one. I turn the page and either walk away and come back because I don't want to, for one thing, I'm more likely to not like it than to like it. And so I try to get rid of the whole issue of liking and disliking and try to get it to something else. It's about something else. It doesn't have a name.
It seems kind of reasonable to assume that you're working with seeing the essence in things, seeing the essence in the rock, and seeing the essence in the powers of gravity. I'd just like to ask, what made you see those essences and work with them the way you have? Mm-hmm. What's a story you could tell from your childhood or your life that helped you see those things? Because a lot of times people talk about the ideas they have, mm-hmm. but they don't tell us how they got there. Don't tell us the story behind it. It's uh-huh. something that happened in childhood or last week or the other day. And I think maybe that telling those stories makes us a little bit more aware of where this all comes from. So
I don't know if I can.
To ask
yeah, that's a nice question. I don't know. I mean, I went up to an ice cream man once when I was a kid, and I said, "How much is a 10-cent ice cream cone?" And he looked at me like, "What are you, stupid?" You know, and it was so embarrassing, and I was so horrified that I think I needed art from that moment on. But you know, I hate embarrassment. I hate it. You know, it's just you want to go hide in the corner, and then you crawl back out. You know, but. Essences. I don't believe in essences.
Okay.
I think that things have their nature, but I don't. In other words, the problem with an essence is that you think when you've got it, you think you've got it, and that's another. That just becomes another static point. I mean, I'm attracted to things as though they had essences. I agree with that. You know, I agree. I think that's natural for human beings. It's that I just have to get to the essence of this incredible situation, of this really beautiful whatever. But I think the idea that it's really there is very dangerous.
Or that it's singular.
Or that it's, yeah.
Yeah, they're meant.
Yeah, like that. Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's not like singular. It's what you saw, or what she, or he, or I.
Right. So it's more like being in a state where that excitement about connection with things that are somehow mysteriously alive, because everything is alive in a mysterious way, it's in its own way, but that you don't go to that place of essence. You don't claim that it has an essence.
Right.
Instead, it's like, I don't want to claim that there is a God or that there isn't. I don't want to claim anything. I just don't think it's necessary. I think it's a step that human beings have taken at their peril to claim that they know something. I mean, I'm an American. What is it? You know, where's it going to stop? You'll bomb them. I mean, really, if you believe in something too much, you lose your aliveness, you lose your humanity, you lose your presence, you lose your sense of the immediacy of the incredible issues of human life that are right there. Because you already know, you know. You know the good guys and the bad guys before you know by their uniform.
So.
What?
Physics.
Physics. And, you know, what we're dealing here with is the gravitational pull of the Earth. directly in line with your gravitation. Are you thinking about the huge conglomerate rock of the Earth and being sort of unified with the Earth when you're dealing with these structures? Is that a thought that you have about being sort of lined up with the pull of Earth's gravity?
Well, first of all, I'm not thinking about much of anything. To me, thinking making art is like not necessary. You're in the process, and the thinking is in your body, it's in your mind, it's in every place, but you don't have to think about it. Just to sort of state that. The second thing is that I regard gravity as a hypothesis. I'm not convinced that we have a handle on that at all. You know, I know what it feels like, and I know what it looks like, the thing that we call gravity, and all that. But actually, I think it's another one of those assumptions which isn't necessarily productive to think you know it that is there. I would assume that there's just as much a force of levity, for instance, as there is of gravity. In fact, I'll tell you that I do have a certain experience with these things that is very hard to defend rationally, which is that there comes a certain moment when I'm working with two stones, and I find the stones individually, right? But by attraction, I got to take that stone home with me. Sometimes it's huge, and I really regret having this policy that any stone that winks at me, I've got to take home. But, I do have it with stones, at least. But then you got them there. And they're hanging out with you, and one day they sort of attract each other. You something like that, and you start to work with them, and then they declare this situation where you feel very uncomfortable. You don't know why you're doing it. It's an uncomfortable situation. Over time, working with them, they start to manifest something, and it comes a certain point where you feel an actual attraction between them, and this is a very powerful moment. And then they may still be quite heavy and difficult to work with, and the body might still be hurting. But there comes a point where I call the still point, where that all stops, everything clears, and they're just very light. And you might be working with a big stone, but because it has found this relationship to the stone under it, it's now extremely light, really light. The stone that was breaking the back a moment ago is suddenly like a butterfly or something. It's got its own force. And at that point, it's a question of keeping the focus and surrendering and letting it determine where it's going to go in that state. And I tell you there's something like levity there.
Excuse me. I would like to put again.
Yeah.
The gate is here. I would like to come back to Richard.
Yeah.
The idea of the warrior together, which is an interesting point.
Because we love each other.
I would like to talk a little bit about the natural phenomenon that both have in the show. The idea of weakness in the sense of arte debole, the Italian idea that the art was, I translate, it's called the small amount of apparently art things. Because they look almost like art. And then you realize that they're working with light, with weight, and with natural phenomena. And also, the idea that this is a show which is not political. And it's very difficult to do a show today which is not political. And I'm very proud that it's not political, because politics are terrible. So, go on, and first particularly, because I think this is not two people show, this is one show. That was my idea. And the reason why I asked you that from the beginning, because
first, we have to discover.
So you don't know each other before?
No, no. We have to. We have to discover. First of all, do we agree that it's not political?
Yeah, Richard, I would like to see, because you also take not stone, but you take the light and you transform it very carefully, very softly. I see the procedure. Thank you. The procedure of both of you are very slow and very delicate and very, not very brutal, not very ready for the material. This is one of the phenomenal way of the book. Richard.
I would say it's, first of all, it's not just light, because that would be to reduce it. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I find returns me to working this way is the fact that very quickly, as I'm listening to what I'm doing or watching, that it's never just about the thing that's there. Like, I'm in this particular case, I was interested in the fact that trying to address the nature of slot, but also the site here, and in the end, that there's really nothing of. I didn't want to work with natural phenomena. I wanted to work with the conditions that were here, and what I realized was that there was this flow of stuff going on outside of on Walnut Street, and this stubborn sink, which is always a sort of a perennial presence in the back of the front room there. And it occurred to me that there's also a flow. It's sort of tapped or stopped sometimes, but I hope this will answer your question, but what I was trying to do was to show that, I mean, I'm thinking about where that water is coming from, where all that traffic is going to, and this, the sense that it's not stopping. It's always light, never stops. It always keeps going, and that suddenly that you're into these very larger parameters that have nothing to do with the figure or the shape of a cloud, but these things that are very hard to actually separate from each other. And suddenly you get a sense that just by creating this condition of a little separation from life or the world, that you're overwhelmed by the things that want to announce themselves as subjects. And so the problem for me is, how do I, maybe this reflects your response, like, where is the art? And to some extent, I don't care, because in the end, I think art is what makes life more interesting than art. And that's to quote Robert Filliou. You probably know that. And the whole point is that I don't really... And in that sense, it is political. Because to care about art more than life, I think, is a statement there, perhaps. I mean, I've said enough.
I have a problem with the separation of the category of the political. I know exactly what you mean, but I mean, nevertheless, I still have a problem with that, because it seems to me that being is political. Anything you do is a statement, and you're making that statement all the time in what you do and what you are. And I mean, I think it's political not to kill people. It's political not to insult people. It's political. So it's not just political what you do and what you say you're for. It's also political what you've learned to resist. Because everybody wants to kill somebody some of the time. But you don't. That's political. That's a statement. That's how I want to be. And I want to live in a world in which that's the case. So that's I'm voting for that, you know, at that moment. So, I mean, these very minute acts. I think of Richard's art as political as anything, in the sense that, I mean, what an incredible thing to work with that state of receptivity. I watched him doing this thing with the sink. It was one of the most beautiful, amazing things. I kept going in there and sort of watching this things he was doing in the wall. This is what I call configurative. I mean, in the sense that everybody's worried about whether something is figurative or abstract or non-figurative or whatever. But actually, the fact is that we're configuring reality all the time. I think the problem is that we configure it rather monotonously and stupidly a lot of the time. And that watching the way he was working with the water was just amazing. It was just so, it was like the water, actually. It had the quality and the condition of the aliveness of the water. And some of what I find in the drawings, for instance, or in video, are very similar kinds of situations. I felt very great affinity for him at that point. Very beautiful. That, and what you came up with in the end is incredible. I mean, the way you finally worked it out.
It's funny because I feel it's unfinished to some extent. Like, I mean, it's if you opened up that box and saw what was going on inside there.
Yeah, right.
I mean, there's duct tape in there, among other things. But it's, I mean, the sense that basically I had to stop because 5 o'clock arrived, and I get a sense sometimes that's I was saying this to somebody today that's maybe what painters feel, but the sense of the sort of infinity of options that suddenly become available within a very narrow framework. And
well, it's like this guy asked a question about your childhood. To me, the horrible moment was when they said you had to stop the game. It's 5 o'clock, dinner time. Got to come in now. You know, it happens every day.
I have to gain weight, so maybe I'll
Wow. That's a good question, because, I mean, to some extent, I mean, I mentioned that before, that the issue about where's the art, first of all, that all I'm doing is basically harnessing or demonstrating a physical phenomenon. And to some extent, we both could be accused of being phenomenologists, which is, I think that's fine. I mean, but so there's this, first of all, the reliance on the lens itself, and then feeling somewhat disabled, maybe is not the right word, but I'm somebody who I think, partly because I work as a curator, I'm incredibly lazy. I'm really, really busy, but very, very lazy at the same time. And all I want sometimes is just to be quiet and plug as much as I can and maybe be in a room with one of these things, and yet I can never, that never happens. And so out of the desire to get close to that and recognizing the limitations that I have, I create these situations where I get other people to assist, because if I were to do it myself, I'd never get anywhere. I mean, it would take me 3 days to do something the people that helped me could do in an hour, and I'm not kidding. So I struggle with the learning curve. And I mean, one thing I admire about your work is that it's like, it's so elemental that, you know, and this is a side thing, but how do you, the idea that somebody could go out there and make your work in terms of the sort of, because I actually do think you have a skill. You said that you didn't. Right. But and I sometimes wonder what my skill is, and I'm not quite sure I could answer that. But it comes from focusing my own desire to see those things enough so that it becomes administrative. It becomes all of the, you know, all the things that we don't want to be talking about that are required in order to get the floor swept and the door open. And maybe that's an answer, but.
I see that you have another thing in common, which is a kind of work that has different levels of aesthetic value. And everybody can come here, look at the stones, or look at the towers, and enjoy the thing without knowing nothing or more than that. And this is a fact, in my opinion, very important about this show, and why I put it together. Because I believe that it's possible that more than that can be understood by everybody, depending on the degree of context that we want to put. This is a show to attract people of any kind of and also you, which sounds like this. Even if you don't know them, then you know that I believe you. Then if you know Sarah, you see, okay, this is about the contraposition of Sarah, it's about levitation. I mean, that a lot of connotation who grows and grows and grows. The more you know, the more you see. One of the reasons why I put this show together is because the more you know, the more you see. And also because I didn't see people. But I saw with Aaron last year, the show of Richard. I knew the work of Richard so. But then I saw the show in the
Prince Center.
Yeah. And I said, we have to do something with Richard. You remember? I didn't know when and how. Then I was with the dealer in New York of George. He pulled out the book of George. You know, I like this art because it doesn't look like art in the beginning. You read. And I like art that doesn't look like. So immediately I went to this place, also where he lives, in the mandala, you know, this big place that you see. And I realized that I have another point. And then I saw that maybe not to do one room, everything in one room, two rooms. And I said, this is an interesting combination from the point of view. What art can do out of a normal situation with art, it's always pushing art and art and art. There are spiritual values, philosophical values on these shows, both, who are interesting to promote for me. And I seem for sure to. That's why the show. And you answered more or less the question, but I think the public maybe has other questions. Please.
I have one question about. Relationships.
In terms of recording, or?
Yes, because in an odd sort of way, we go and look at this, and we have a memory. So the memory of that order going up is constructed through our counter memory of the order going down. And so I don't know that I want to push you in that direction, but I'm curious as to what you
want. Well, you're right. I mean, to talk about gravity as being some larger imperative in my work is to, you know, that's just one way that the two bodies of work, I think, connect. But for me, you put your finger on it. I mean, in terms of, I'm very interested in this idea of time and also the present moment, but also the way, to some extent, all this work comes about as a critique of photography, and which I think of as a way of concretizing and making material experience. But it there's always that backward glance. With photography, I'm very interested in, there's a great book by someone named Jeffrey Batchen called Burning with Desire that talks about the fact that the phenomena in the other room had actually been used and operative and enjoyed for centuries before photography established a way of chemically fixing and almost materializing experience. And I think, I mean, in a way, this is photography without... anyone who's ever stood in front of a view camera, I mean, this is one of the great stories I've heard from people who teach photography. They send out their students with the 8x10 view camera, and what comes back are the worst pictures that ever, because the kids are just so seduced by the phenomena of time flowing through the... And, you know, I actually... The only art education I have is a... I tried to take a darkroom class once, and halfway through, I just quit because I hated the darkroom. I hated the chemicals, and that piece, the sink, in a way, to some extent, is a reference to the fact that I love the dry side of camera optics, and the wet side. And the whole point somehow is that photography, in the end, becomes a kind of fetishization of previous experience, which is fine. And I love the photography, don't get me wrong, but for me, the state of being grounded in what you call the thickness of the present, as well as this childlike sense of, wow, what color car is going to come by next? I mean, that sounds like a very silly thing. It's also a kind of stoned mentality, whatever, but to revel and to be given permission and to have that kind of experience without any kind of, almost involuntarily, to be placed in that relationship to the thing. I mean, the notion that we're all going to walk outside on Walnut Street and think that Walnut Street is the same as it is in here. I mean, that some all of those things are is the way you talked about the water. Suddenly, like, everyday life has a chance to become a little bit less habituated, and we're memorizing all the time. I think perception, to some extent, is a playing of tapes. And what I'm interested in is the way that we can be reminded that it's such an amazing thing just to wake up and be alive and turn on the faucet. And I mean, that sounds so ridiculous in a way, but to some extent, it's motivated by through what you're talking about with time, sort of be connected to what's going on right now.
On that note,
we have to make personal question to both because we want people to see the show. So you can ask them one by one because people came to see the show from New York and other places. I can take one more question from them, and then you have the possibility to talk to both of them, and I think we will be very happy that I share with you all what they have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You almost answered the question. Okay, who wants to say one more question?
I wanted to ask, in the city of Philadelphia right now, do you think you could set up these kind of works, or you have the kind of images you have, particularly in the front window, and maybe stand there and explain them to people and help them understand things in a different way? So something like the murder rate would drop in Philadelphia, that you would end up crossing a kind of line that is not really crossed in a particular crowd or conversation or class level or education level that's most likely represented in this room at the moment. Do you think you could do that? And is it okay to ask that kind of question to you guys? Would you want to consider even going there?
You're going to ask him that one.
You know, I think that aware activity displaces unaware activity. And to the extent that you could engage people and get them to be more aware, they're probably going to do less of the things that are done from unawareness, right? And all of the dark, bad things that you might mention, like murder, for instance, are done from unawareness. I mean, a lost awareness of some kind, some fundamental loss, right? So in that sense, I mean, it's an honest and real question, and I think we ought to think about that and try to do that kind of thing as much as possible. But it's not easy, and it's be kind of quixotic to sort of set out to do it. You know, in some way, would be.
Thank you for asking the question. Let's enjoy the show. Thank you both.
Thank you.